feeling pretty grateful that the only chemical I have a crippling addiction to is caffeine, and I don't need a shady doctor or a drug dealing operation to get my hands on that. I just need to go to sparkplugcoffee.com. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend if you'd like to shake it up. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this splendid coffee to your home or office within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Well, hello, all you film freakies, and thank you for downloading the next 179 project, your Monday morning dose of classic movies. Our 123 podcasts about the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of excellent American-made motion pictures are online, and they're free for you anytime. Warning. We will be spoiling Darren Aronofsky's drug movie, and others, too. I'm the guy who's thinking thin and gonna be on television, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who likes to be excited, straight from Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, it is Requiem for a Dream, one of the few movies that's ever had the word Requiem in the title. Alien, one of those movies, Alien vs. Predator had a Requiem. I don't know why. Okay, anyway, the coming attractions trivia. What's the one addiction you could never, ever give up?
Well, since I have actually given up caffeine before, successfully, I will never give up my addiction of giving classic film hot takes to you, loyal Top 100 listeners.
Weak.
Also, alcohol. What's yours, Ryan?
Alcohol's on the list. Pop is on the list.
Cheers.
Obviously, it could be taken away by an apocalypse or something, but the internet. YouTube. Ooh. Especially. I am on YouTube every single day, with very rare exceptions. We're going to be on vacation a week after this podcast airs, and I won't be online much there, and some days maybe not at all. I'll use my phone, but it may not have... Well, then again, all modern resorts have Wi-Fi, don't they? But we've been on vacations where we couldn't use the Wi-Fi. So maybe in a way I can obviously get by without it. But then if you took my phone away too and it was just read books on the beach... Wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I'm really a book reader, though. So really, that's why I look at that. I say, when I'm home on my normal life, I'm online every single day. Not as much as some people. I'm not a huge Twitter person. I'm on Twitter sometimes, Facebook as well. Emails, of course. But really, it comes down to YouTube and probably the IMDb. So I think that's the one I probably really couldn't give up. Because I've given up booze for days on end. And I've given up pop for days on end. Well, not usually days on end, but a little while at least.
I've given up alcohol for pretty long periods of time. But I never, ever stopped missing it. I gave up coffee for a long time and eventually I stopped missing it, but I never stopped missing the drink.
I never smoked and I never even really... Might have tried coffee when I was young, I guess, but otherwise I've never been into those two things, so I can't even relate to what that's like. I'm sure that's way worse than... Well, not as bad as what these people go through in this movie. Let's get into that then.
All right.
Addiction, the motion picture, was released 20 years ago by Artisan Entertainment in November and December of 2000. I remember seeing this movie at the Carlton Theater here in Toronto. It was not a very good theater, not a very good sound system for what is a great sound movie, but it was a powerful experience.
It's surprising to learn that this movie is 20 years old, maybe because it felt so fresh when it came out. Not to say it looks dated. Well, it does look dated, the music and the fashion. You're like, oh yeah, this movie's 20 years old. Mm.
The budget was pretty micro, but the movie still just eked out a tiny profit. Debatably, didn't really make a profit, but it wasn't a money loser exactly either. Okay, Bev, remind people what this 20-year-old movie is about with the Requiem for a Dream skinny.
Jared Leto is Harry Goldfarb, a habitual heroin user and cautionary tale who partners up with his friend Tyrone, played by Marlon Wayans, to cut heroin and sell it for a profit so that he can help his girlfriend Marion, played by Jennifer Connelly, open up a boutique. Meanwhile, Harry's mom Sarah, played by Ellen Burstyn...
Be excited! Ellen excited!
has turned a weight loss scheme into a full-blown speed addiction. It takes only 9 months for each character to become an extreme and unique worst-case scenario.
You on the uppers, ain't you? Okay, in a nutshell, Speed Freak dreams of being in an infomercial. Very small dreams.
It can't possibly be that hard to be an audience member on an infomercial.
Well, she wants to be a guest star. Because she is straight from Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. She wants to be on the show. And when we see Ellen Burstyn all gussied up, and the woman was nearly 70 years old, she looked fantastic. But yeah. It is makeup, and it's obviously a performance. It's hair, looking a little crazy. Fat suits. Early on, she has got a fatter suit on. There's one shot I read on the Goofs before we started watching the movie, and I definitely saw it. When she's trying on the red dress, and you see in the mirror that's behind her where the fat suit is, clearly. But anyway, when you see Ellen Burstyn just looking like herself at that point, man, still foxy.
Yeah, she was a beautiful woman.
And she was nominated for an Oscar for this movie, but Julia Roberts won. Julia was maybe overdue, debatably. I wasn't a huge fan of hers at that point. I like her more now, maybe because she's a little older. We don't see her as much anymore, and it feels more special to see Julia Roberts presenting Best Picture this past year. Well, last year, I guess now, for Green Book at the Oscars. But at this point, her performance, Erin Brockovich, the best that year, I don't know. Burstyn had won before. It wasn't like she never had. And I think she should have won for this performance. This is Burstyn's favorite of her own performances, the one she thinks she was the best in. And it is over the top, but the movie's over the top, so it certainly fits the theme. The critics liked the movie, but not that much, though, really. 79% of them on Rotten Tomatoes said yes, 107 fresh, 29 rotten, and the average was 7.4 out of 10, which is okay. But the audiences love it. 93% of people who voted on Rotten Tomatoes say yes, and 89th is where this movie sits on the IMDb 250. And that same ballpark, 2001 A Space Odyssey, Vertigo, I think Citizen Kane, they're all around there, and there's Requiem for a Dream hanging out with it. I thought actually it was even higher. When I looked, I thought maybe it was going to see be 45th or 48th or something, but 89th is still pretty impressive. It was 160th at the 2000 U.S. box office. The Grinch, meaning the Ron Howard movie, was number one. And Bring It On, which Chris and I covered last year, was 37th. And Traffic, which probably should have won Best Picture, the other big drug movie that year, the more realistic one, was 15th. And that might very well get covered by us pretty soon, in fact, at least sometime this year. Also 20 years old, of course. I mentioned the Oscar nomination for Burstyn. That's all this movie got, even for nominations. Nothing for makeup, nothing for sound, nothing for the music, and even the big ones. I think picture and director would have been worthwhile. Maybe the screenplay, the adapted screenplay from Hubert Selby's book, but I think especially the music. And the last plaudit, it was nominated for the top 100 list in 2007, the second AFI list. It could have been nominated the first time, of course, because the first one was 1998.
You didn't mention editing. I think if there's an Oscar this film deserved, it was an editing Oscar.
I'm a little bit surprised to hear you say that, because I thought maybe you would have thought this movie was over-edited. But then that is the style. Okay, yeah. What about the music then? I just said I think it was worthwhile. The Kronos Quartet and Clint Mansell, I guess is how you say his name. This has become a score that is in movie trailers by the thousands. And a lot of the great scores are.
It was too ahead of its time. It is a very electronic score. And that's just not what the Academy voters reward. You think a bunch of men in their 60s... we're listening to this and thinking that in the year 2000, that was the best score of the year. They just didn't get it.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon won for the score that year. And that's a good choice. I can't really argue with that one. All right, well then, your initial thoughts. We've been talking here for a while, but your initial thoughts on a movie you picked, of course, your second in the fifth annual month of Bev, Requiem for a Dream.
So I hadn't seen this movie in a while. I watched it a lot when it first came out. Stylistically, it really holds up. Aronofsky has this amazing gift for putting his audience square in the mental state of characters on the brink of insanity.
Or past it.
Yes, absolutely. Technically, it's a real accomplishment, and we'll talk about just how vastly influential it was. Thematically, not as enduring. If we thought Trainspotting veered a little too close into that after-school special territory, this movie takes a page from Reefer Madness, and it's a little much.
May I quote one of the great movies of all time? Hello, McFly. McFly, do you get it, McFly?
Drugs
do
you are get bad! It?
Drugs are bad for you! Not that Traffic the same year was all that subtle either, but it was certainly subtler than this movie was. Now, you're the one that said it when we saw Ellen Burstyn really going over the top towards the end and going completely insane. Does speed do that to you? Even when you're mixing your pills?
Up.
She was mixing her pills. That's one factor, but okay.
So it's called amphetamine psychosis. It's a real thing that happens, but it's quite rare. It happens with about 1 in 1,000 speed users. And of those people that happens to, most of them will just make a full recovery by ceasing the drug use. But about 5 to 15% of those never recover fully, like Sarah. So it's not impossible, but it's incredibly unlikely for her situation to happen. I think part of the reason it's believable when it happens to her is that she seems to have a screw loose before she ever starts using drugs.
Yeah, she's so lonely.
She's lonely, but not just that. She's delusional. She thinks she's going to be on TV. She thinks that a TV appearance will somehow change her life.
Television. She's going to be on television.
She's shocked to discover that she's gained too much weight to fit into that dress. She's incredibly guileless for someone her age, and she trusts and forgives Harry over and over. She takes her friend's bad advice about the doctor. Doesn't recognize the obvious red flags coming from that doctor who prescribes her the amphetamines.
Doesn't even look at her. The first time.
Yeah, it's so obvious.
When she goes back, he does. I noticed that. I had a note earlier that he doesn't look at her at all. But the second visit, he does at least glance her way.
Yeah, but she's saying, I'm having these hallucinations. And he's just like, fill the prescription, see you in a week.
Yeah.
Which, it's one of the touches of this film that is a little heavy-handed.
He's busy, though, and I'm sure the doctors have to go through that, where they can't really truly spend time with patients, especially in a big city like New York.
Sure. Isn't he specifically a weight loss doctor? Isn't that his whole thing?
I don't know. Did they say that?
I think that's what's implied, that his clinic is strictly about weight loss. And listen, people go to those clinics and get very sick. It is true that there are clinics that are much more interested in making money than having people lose weight in a healthy way. And there's a couple of notorious programs where people have died. People with heart conditions or what have you have pushed their bodies to too far extremes and absolutely lost their lives while medically supervised trying to pursue weight loss. So that's not completely unbelievable.
I don't know anything about weight loss and pills and all that kind of stuff, especially the way she's doing it. But once she's taken the weight loss pills, and of course they are speed, and they make her clean her apartment fast. That's a great shot. The panning shot. You see her clean the whole apartment because she's really up.
Lapse, yeah.
But I think the first thing she does after the pills is she starts eating food that, if you want to lose weight, you shouldn't be eating. A bagel just slathered in cream cheese and then dancing around, which is a fun little scene. Burstyn actually is a little bit betraying her fat suit situation there because she's pretty dexterous. She's moving around quite well for someone who's supposed to be, not that she's huge, but older and overweight. Anyway, I'm asking you, maybe you don't know, if you're taking pills to counteract weight gain, and you want to start losing weight, and you keep eating stuff that you probably shouldn't be eating in the first place, and you're eating even more of it maybe, do you know what happens there? Is that worse?
I always understood that part of the way speed works is it curbs your appetite. You don't really want to eat. Meal times will come and go, and you don't really think about it.
For her, later in the movie, that seems to be true.
Well, so she takes right away, one though. Pill, and the first thing she does is pig out and laugh at the fridge. Like, oh, I got the better of you. But that's the last time we ever see her eat, I think.
One of, for sure. Most of the movie, or at least the second half of the movie, yeah, you never see her eat anything other than pills.
Her addiction initially is sugar, food. She eats her feelings. She sits in front of the TV, which she's also addicted to, and just numbs herself with food and watching the same infomercial that seems to play 24 hours a day. Tappy, what is
juice
he selling?
Juice by Tappy, juice by Tappy.
So it's juice? That's what he's selling?
Well, he has the three rules. One is no red meat. The second one is no sugar. And we never do hear number three. Apparently, it was going to be no orgasms, which is odd. It has nothing to do with your health. Yeah. Don't have sex. And I was also reading that Aronofsky asked Marlon Wayans and Jared Leto to abstain from sex and sugar for, I don't know, weeks or a month to know what it feels like to be in the same situation as these guys. So maybe that does jibe. And that may be from the book, too, Hubert Selby's book. I'm not sure. But I was also reading that Aronofsky wanted it to be, the third thing, pharmaceuticals. But then they thought, oh, God, we won't get away with it if it's pharmaceuticals because we'll get, maybe not sued, but we'll be in trouble with them if you're saying don't take pharmaceutical pills and don't go to Pfizer and whatever else. Except the irony is that Sarah's maybe the worst off of the four of them, and she's taking legal pills. Her doctor's given them to her.
Well, let me ask you a question. Of the four characters who all have very bad outcomes, which one scares you the most personally? Which?
Hers.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Harry could recover. Maybe he's learned a hard lesson by having an arm cut off.
Lots of people live missing limbs.
And Marion now being an official prostitute, because that's what she seems like she's going to be, could recover. She's still very young.
And you can stop being a prostitute the day you decide to stop being
a prostitute. She still has an avenue with a rich family. Maybe she can go to them, to them, maybe get clean, and that could still be better, possibly. Tyrone's got the best chance to succeed. I think Aronofsky even said that. Because Tyrone, even though he's obviously an addict, isn't nearly as bad off as Harry and Marion are.
Yeah, that's true. He doesn't seem nearly as dependent as they are. Although he's suffering sickness when he's in prison and he's throwing up, it's because he's going through withdrawal. Mm. That's why he's so sick. But yeah, you are under the impression that he's less of a slave to the drugs
as they are. He could kick it. Maybe he won't, but he could. Mm-hmm. They're all very young. Well, not Sarah, but the other three are quite young. And I was reading also that Aronofsky wanted it to be even younger.
Oh, really?
And Selby's book wasn't that they were 13 or 14 years old. We're talking more like the movie Kids, where they're messed around, and some of them have AIDS, one of them at least has AIDS, and at the end of the movie he gives it to somebody else, probably, because he fucks her without a condom, rapes her, effectively, without a condom. But those kids were kids. And these kids are more 20 or maybe it's even 25 years old, possibly. But Aronofsky's saying, let's have it be even younger. But again, like the pharmaceuticals thing, I think even a studio like Artisan said, we can't push this too hard. Nobody will ever see this movie if we do that and go that far with this.
They did that a little with Basketball Diaries. How old is he supposed to be in Basketball Diaries?
I don't recall.
Very successful, critically acclaimed film. Maybe he's supposed to be in his 20s. He just looked so young. Leonardo DiCaprio, back then, he really did still look like a kid. I can't remember how old he's supposed to be.
You know what I'm reminding myself of, though, is when we talked about Taxi Driver, that as much as that movie's controversial, it isn't as racist as it was intended in the original screenplay, because all the people that Bickle goes after were black in the original script. He does kill black guys, but it isn't mostly black guys. Everybody in the brothel at the end of the movie are not black, actually. And I guess part of that would be that it's not very subtle. The guy's blatantly a racist. Because when people bring that up, the first few times I saw the movie, I didn't really realize what they mean about the racism stuff, but that's why it would have been. Also in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, maybe we covered one of those we covered a long time ago. Why are the stakes for what Jeff is trying to fight against a dam? Why is it that? Well, because you're already saying that senators are corrupt. So you can't put down too much shit on these guys. And this might be the same thing. You've got a controversial movie, but you don't want it to be little kids, and you don't want it to be that they go too far, and so on and so on. What you see with Marion at the end, where she's, God, man, ass to ass, it's graphic enough. But I think it could have been even more graphic, and maybe that's what Aronofsky wanted. He wanted to go so far over the top.
20 years after this film was made, I was having a conversation with my friend of mine about something, and she used that scene in this movie as a specific reference to, I can't let things get too far. I can't let it turn into that scene in Requiem. Talking about how she had to watch herself, whether it was like her alcohol consumption or whatever. She's like, oh, you gotta watch yourself, otherwise you're gonna be the ass-to-ass girl in Requiem.
You know what worries me about that scene, actually, more so than her going through that? Because that isn't so bad, I guess. I wouldn't want to do it. The point being that she and the other girl are surrounded by these guys who are cheering this on.
Oh, it's like a cockfight. You expect them all to have fistfuls of cash or something, like they're at a prize fight. It's such a bizarre thing. I'm like, what event was that? I think it's like an Aronofsky exaggeration is what
yes,
it is.
And we don't see anything beyond the ass to ass. Next time we see her, she goes back to her place dressed again and smiles as she's got her heroin and curls up like they all do to the right in the fetal position. That's the way every one of the characters ends the movie, curled to the right on a bed or on a couch or what have you. But you could argue that maybe not that time, but some other time she goes to a party like that with Big Tim, Keith David. They are taken into separate rooms, and maybe not any or even all those guys are actually going to be rapists, but the way that they're so objectifying these women, and like we just said, cockfight or even worse, I'm picturing the worst for her.
Well, Big Tim doesn't seem like much of a prince. Hmm. When we finally meet him, he seems like a real creep. There's no way you would trust him to do right by her in any way.
I didn't take it out for air.
Yeah, that line makes my skin crawl.
Well, Keith David has such an awesome voice, too, and he's such a big dude. And he's been in so many movies at that point and so many since. That when you get somebody like that, who's barely in the movie, it has such an effect. Hmm. So they shot the movie in New York, of course, between April and June of 1999. The movie came out the following fall and into the winter, so big post-production, of course, with the editing that's done this movie, no wonder. I was reading that there's something like three times as many edits as you'd have in a movie that's about an hour and 40 minutes.
It's montages. They happen pretty frequently. They're really fast, with intention, with those hard audio cuts.
Well, also the same thing's done over and over again. I'm sure they recycled some of the shots when they're doing drugs, and one of the shots in the cut is an eye that's expanding. I was reading that when you do heroin, actually your eyes constrict, one of those two. Hmm. They don't dilate. They don't get bigger. They get smaller.
We always associate drugs with dilated pupils, I think, because of hallucinogenics. If you've ever seen someone high on acid, their pupils are massive.
Well, in this heroin movie, no one actually says heroin.
They call it pushing off.
Yeah, and they want a pound of pure rather than saying heroin itself. We've already talked about addictions and what we couldn't give up, and Sarah, of course, with their diet pills, and the other three with their illegal drugs. But really, the addiction in this movie, for Sarah at least, is even bigger than television, because she has that addiction too, like you said. But it's family. And they all have this longing for the past. Tyrone wants the mother he used to have. And I don't know if that's supposed to be this fantasy, that she was really this loving mother. Maybe she wasn't. But anyway, he wants that life either again or for the first time. Harry's a connection with all three of them. It's his best friend, his girlfriend, and his mother. They're the other three main characters. And Harry wants Marion to be happy, and he knows, although he is Jared Leto, he's a great-looking guy himself, but he's out of his league with Marion because Jennifer Connelly, wow. And then for a little while, she's the most successful because she's a legit business. These two effectively want to be drug entrepreneurs.
Yeah, they're just drug dealers.
And they want that pound of pure, and then they cut it up. And we see them do things like that anyway, but they don't really have the pound of pure yet. They build up the money, they put it in shoeboxes in the closet, and then they, or a hole in the wall, whatever, and then they end up taking it out, and they, of course, go broke. But Connelly, as Marion, is the one who, for a little while, has a legit job as well, because the money helps her open up a boutique, and of course, she's got the shrink who gave us our money to, Sean Gillette. I think he was the main star in Pi, the movie that Aronofsky made before this.
Yes, yeah, I think he was.
Of course, Aronofsky is like a lot of directors. He uses actors over and over again. Louise Lasser, I think, wasn't... No, maybe not her. Marcia Jean Kurtz, definitely, who plays Ray, one of the two friends Sarah has, was in at least three of his other movies. She was in The Wrestler, which Chris and I covered last year, and you and I covered Mother. I don't think she was in that, but she was in Black Swan. And then I think every movie he's made has had Mark Margolis, who is Hector in Breaking Bad. And Better Call Saul, of course, too. Mr. Rabinowitz, he's the pawn guy, pawn broker. I don't know if you'd even really call him that. It's not like he has a business, per se. It's on the beach down at Coney Island. And that's the opening of the movie. Harry, in a way, is stealing Sarah's TV to sell it to that guy so he can get money for drugs. And it's such a routine that Mr. Rabinowitz recognizes her. It's not even a matter of, I think I know you. They're like old friends.
Well, when he brings a TV, what does he say? He's like, your mother needs you, like she needs a hole in the head or something like that. He has some line to that effect.
So why not?
He knows he's buying the TV. I don't know why she
just give Harry
give
the money.
Him money.
Might as well. And also, it's two of them that take that TV down there. It's on wheels, of course, but take it all the way down to Coney Island. And then she brings it back by herself, somehow. It's one of those things you're not supposed to think about, I guess.
It's a neat image, though, to start the movie with them just walking around New York. Where is Coney Island, though? Staten Island?
Near Brooklyn.
Oh, it's near Brooklyn.
Yeah, and that's where they are, is Brooklyn. Yeah. Brighton Beach.
It's a neat image to start the movie with, just the two of them walking around Brooklyn, pushing a TV around on wheels.
While the credits are going, yeah. And then the closing credits show pictures and whatnot and sounds from Coney Island. So I mentioned that Tappy Tibbins is saying no red meat, no sugar, and that's what helped him lose weight, because his character is supposed to have been someone who was overweight as well. Tappy lost a lot of weight, now he's a motivational speaker. Christopher McDonald, I guess, shot his scenes in a day, or maybe it was a couple of days. People were amazed by that. He improvised a lot, too. And he's in more of the movie than I remember. I'd forgotten how much of when she starts hallucinating that the whole set is coming alive. Her living room becomes the infomercial
cool.
set.
Yeah.
And he's with her in this weird way where she's dressed in the red dress and she looks younger. Not as good as she did, looks in the very end of the movie when she just looks normal, but she's got freaky hair, Bride of Frankenstein hair. But he's a big part of that, too. So he shot, if there was only one day, it must have been one hell of a long day. He's in the movie more than I remembered. But then he basically is always doing the Juice by Tappy stuff. Those are the five main characters. They're big four, especially. Ben McDonald is the fifth bill person. Probably is the fifth most screen time. They're over the top, especially Burstyn. But what did you think of the performances? Do you agree that she probably should have won the Oscar this year, especially over Julia Roberts?
I like Julia Roberts' performance in Erin Brockovich. I'm going to defend her with that. But I also agree that Ellen Burstyn is amazing. Darren Aronofsky has many great talents. And one of them is that he can get these outrageously extreme performances out of his actors, and yet it doesn't feel like it's too much. It never goes into Nicolas Cage territory where you are tempted to laugh at them. You're never tempted to laugh at Sarah. You are always just as invested in this extreme performance as she is. And the same goes for Mother, which we talked about. Black Swan is another great example where you can just buy into it. He has such a gift for that.
And maybe the very best performance in any movie he's ever directed, I still stand by it. I said it last year and Chris and I covered it, would be Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler.
A movie I don't like.
Okay.
But my unpopular opinion.
But you're going to give props to him in that performance.
Sure. Got to be honest, I didn't finish it. I couldn't. It was, listen, I had a really bad day. I watched it on the wrong day, and I feel like I'm always going to associate that movie with that terrible day. I watched it because I was trying to distract myself from something terrible that happened. Let's just say it didn't work. Sorry.
It's a shame. It's a hell of a good film.
It's not the movie's fault, but I can't stand it.
And of all the lead performances we just mentioned, it might be the most contained and the most real. Burstyn's over the top. She still feels real, but she's, well, we'll say it, way over the top. Natalie Portman won an Oscar for Black Swan. Not so much, actually, Jennifer Lawrence and Mother. It's more the other characters. They're like that. The movie itself is so big in Mother.
By the end, she is freaking out pretty good.
Of course, for good reason. But one thing this movie is big on, and I think the other movies Aronofsky has done too, but especially this one, is ritualistic activity. We see Sarah open up the chocolates, and the way it's shot and the way it's shown is that that's part of the ritual of her doing it. It's not just she has to eat, she's not necessarily even hungry, but it's part of what she does. The TV thing with Harry, and Tyrone for that matter, taking it down to the pawnbroker guy, is part of a ritual for them. Obviously doing the drugs is a ritualistic thing. And they, like in Sandlot, where Chris and I talked about that just recently, where they're trying to retrieve the ball from the junkyard, they enjoy the process. That's part of the thing I like when it comes to drinking, even if it is just pop. I like the process. It always reminds me of the line I probably quoted in this podcast years ago from The West Wing. Leo talks about, because he's a recovered alcoholic, says to somebody, you don't know what ice sounds like going into a glass. Now, I'm not quite as hooked on that as he is, but I've always remembered that, and I like that sound, too. I like that part of it, doing it.
I'm an ex-smoker. I haven't smoked in 12 or 13 years. Still, when I see somebody take a cigarette out of a pack, tap it a couple of times and then light it. It is the action of that that I almost miss more than anything. It wasn't smoking I missed so much as getting in a car, sitting around a campfire. There were certain things where the ritual of including smoking in that was so hard to give up. I know I talk about drinking coffee a lot, but coffee is its own ritual. It's like a whole ordeal to make a cup of coffee. But you go through it and then the smell comes and then you put your sugar in your cream and you have your cup and you go and you do what you're going to do and you enjoy your coffee and it is totally all part of the ritual.
And a lot of us do this kind of stuff all the time and we do have things going on, but none of these four people are really all that busy. They've got time to be hooked on rituals and to be preparing drugs and working through chocolates and making food, all that stuff. Well, speaking of the drugs, Harry and Marion and Tyrone take diet pills in the scene where we see the fast-forwarded party. They have friends over. They're playing music. It looks like Harry was some kind of DJ, or at least he's big into DJing. He's got stereo equipment, not just the typical stuff. Looks like he's actually maybe been a lot of records, too.
Yeah, they're music fans. I like that touch that you actually just see them hanging out, enjoying being high.
Yeah, because they're taking speed, and I guess it's the same pills that Sarah does. I think she's doing them at that point, or she's prescribed
those.
Yeah,
she is, yeah.
And her friend Ada is the one who suggests she try the diet book first, which, of course, doesn't really work. That would have been smarter if she stuck with that, but she wants the fast fix so she can be on television.
Plus, it's too hard for her to stick to the diet. She's hungry. She doesn't like the food. The whole meal. The editing is so cool in this movie. Mm-hmm. The grapefruit is gone in an instant. The egg is gone in an instant. She's just sitting there unsatisfied.
The unsugared coffee.
Forget that. Never.
So I talked a minute ago about performances you raved about Burst, and I totally agree with you. But what about Leto, who had been in Fight Club? We covered that a while ago. And, of course, won the Oscar for Dallas Buyers Club. Jennifer Connelly won the year after this for A Beautiful Mind, supporting performance. But in a lot of ways, the surprise of the four of them is Marlon Wayans. Because you look at his resume, and everything surrounding this, unless there's something I overlooked, is a goofy comedy. There's nothing wrong with doing comedies. We need those in the world, too. The Wayans brothers have made a lot of good ones. Damon has been in some pretty good movies. His brother Damon was in The Last Boy Scout, a pretty damn good performance. But Marlon, I think, is quite good in this, and it's almost like, why didn't you do more of this kind of thing? Even just once in a while, do a more serious movie. Look at Adam Sandler, as many dumb comedies as he's done. He does an Uncut Gems, which people are raving about as we record this podcast, and Punch Drunk Love way back when. Funny People, so every once in a while, he does a movie that matters more. Marlon seems like he went back to doing the dumb comedies, and it's a shame, because he could have, I think, maybe been a serious actor after this, if that's what he wanted. Dave Chappelle was talked about for the role. That would have been an interesting choice.
I feel like comedians tend to prove over and over again that comedy is actually the hardest acting there is. Because so often, over and over, comedians, when they do serious roles, prove that they're phenomenal actors. Recently, we were just having a conversation about what an incredible talent Bill Hader is proving to be, both with his show Barry and what was the movie that you were talking about?
It Chapter 2. I just saw it, and it was not a good movie. But he broke my heart towards the end of that movie.
He's an amazing actor.
The way he reacts to something bad that happens to one of them.
One of the greatest SNL actors of his generation, for sure. Of the years that he was in, he was always a standout. He's incredibly hilarious. He does amazing impressions and characters. I don't think you can do that kind of stuff without just having a real gift for performance.
So comedy's important. I'm just saying that Marlon Wayans showed that he could do more of a broad range and do a Robin Williams kind of thing where you do your silly comedies.
Well, he probably just made way more money with Scary Movie. All those movies probably made him so much more money than Requiem for a Dream ever made him. So maybe that was it. True.
Yeah, you look at the cast. It could have been Faye Dunaway in the Sarah role. It could have been Neve Campbell. In
what?
The Marion role.
Oh, okay.
Well, separate points. So Faye Dunaway, then Neve Campbell as the girlfriend. Faye Dunaway is the mother. But Neve Campbell didn't want to have to do the nudity, although a few years later she was in When Will I Be Loved in full frontal, or at least full upper nudity. So when it's a certain movie, I'll do it, but in other movies I won't. And the Marlon Wayans, as I just mentioned, could have been Dave Chappelle. But as far as Connelly goes, pretty good performance here for sure. People love her from Labyrinth. I mentioned the Oscar she won the next year. She's going to be in Top Gun Maverick later this year. But she was always at the end of a pier in this era. Dark City, this movie, and then House of Sand and Fog. And apparently Aronofsky didn't even know that she was in Dark City or that she was in a shot at the end of a pier, just like she is in this movie multiple times. She, in a lot of ways, is the most compelling character this time. I feel that way. I don't think I've really thought that way before. Because she goes to dinner with a therapist, and she fucks them a few times. And then later on, she actually fucks them and comes out and pukes. And God, I've been talking about that lately, about how many times we see it, more so recently in TV shows and movies than 20 years ago. It seems like we see puke all the time. And this movie does it where it actually makes sense, because Tyrone does it as well.
I never noticed it until you pointed out that it's your pet peeve every time you see puking.
Well, up close, especially.
Well, up close, but also pretty much into the camera. Times people puke under circumstances that they would never normally puke. Movies imply that every time you hear something you don't want to hear, you have to run to the bathroom and vomit immediately. But then it's one thing to imply that someone's puking. It's another thing. I can't remember what I was watching recently, but somebody was vomiting and they decided to put a camera in the toilet and give you like a toilet's eye view so that the actor puked onto plexiglass over the camera lens. Why? Why are we seeing this? As soon as you pointed out that it was your pet peeve, I have over the years been getting more and more annoyed that people lean on this dumb, cheap trick.
I'll give it more of a pass in this movie because it is already so intense and so disgusting. Look at Harry's arm at one point. That's
it makes
disgusting.
Total sense that Tyrone is puking when he's going through withdrawal. That is a natural thing that happens for real.
But Marianne is doing because she's upset. And then she actually, did you notice this? She tidies herself up before she goes back to Harry. And he's pretty much just said, you want drugs, you want money for this, you go out and you fuck the guy. He didn't say that, but he knows that's what's going
to
happen.
And their relationship never really recovers, even though he tells her to do it to get money, and she's mad at him for it, she doesn't want to do it, he still can't look at her afterwards.
But she does show an awful lot of range, because when she imagines stabbing Arnold's hand, the shrink, just an imagination, not a real moment, but she says, you smug fuck, and she's really mad at that moment. She really sells that she wants to kill the guy at that moment, but doesn't do it. And the way she reacts after she fucks him, she's so upset. But one of the most heartbreaking lines I've ever heard in any movie is when she's on the phone with Harry, the last time they ever speak. And maybe they'll never see each other again.
Oh,
very
yeah,
possible.
That seems hard.
But in the movie, it is the last time they have any kind of contact. When she says, can you come today? Because she knows he's not going to. I don't know if she knows that he's gone to Florida. I guess he would probably tell her. At that point, they're still supposed to be dating, involved. I think even living together. But that is a heartbreaking moment.
Yeah, he lies to her and she knows he's lying to her about being able to come and join her. The relationship, as much as they're druggy buddies, you do really feel how much they need each other, how much they love each other.
But she's also a troublemaker, because when they go up on the roof of that building, and Harry rigs it so the alarm won't go off, and they open up the door, they come back through, they're about to just leave. But she's the one that pulls the cable that gets the security guys to go up there, and if they're caught, they would be in some kind of trouble. I mean, what are they going to do, throw these kids in jail?
No, they're just going to throw them out of the building.
But it's her that does it, not him.
That's just her being wild and fun.
Well, she's got rough parents, I think. Or maybe she's imagining that they're really worse than they really are. It could be a Fight Club kind of thing where it's imagining conflict that doesn't need to be there.
I don't think
my life is so hard. Although with her, it certainly becomes hard if it wasn't already.
I don't think that young women that have as much going for them as she has going for her become heroin addicts come from happy, healthy homes. Or maybe she sat that shrink since she was very young. Maybe that's where the trauma came from, was that shrink cross the line. But she seems to have a lot of hatred for her family. She doesn't want anything to do with them. They never really straight out say what happened.
She'll take money from them early on.
Yeah, sure.
That's why she sees the therapist, so they'll keep giving her money.
Oh, that's right.
It's hard to pick a red letter scene in this movie because there are a lot of them. But I guess the big one is, as far as performance goes, especially for Burson, is when Harry visits. And he's certainly an addict, but he doesn't really look that bad at that moment. And he doesn't take her TV this time. Now he's telling her he's buying her a TV. And of course, it's the big screen, big speakers that come days later, it gets delivered. At one point, Burson goes into her, I'm old, that monologue. And apparently Matthew Libatique, the cinematographer who worked with Aronofsky all the time at that point, I think still does now, apparently the shot drifts a little bit because Libatique had fogged up the lens because he was crying when Burson was giving this performance out.
It's
and so Aronofsky had to realize, God, I can't get mad at him for that.
All she wants is grandchildren. I like thinking about the red dress. She has nothing.
And she presses him right away about having a kid. And he's not even married to Marianne. And they're awfully young. They're not as young as they could have been if Aronofsky had had his way.
That's but where I say she was a little off her rocker. She's already using speed at this point. But the way that she pressures him, and he doesn't seem to find her behavior that surprising. But she's already a little far gone before she
I'm not going to imply anything, but I just want to bring this up because I noticed it again. I've always noticed it in this scene when they hug goodbye. And we've all seen people do this where it doesn't have to mean anything. But they hug with their upper halves only. Their crotches are about a foot apart from each other. And it reminds me of the novel, Gerald's Game. I don't think this scene so much is in the movie that's on Netflix, but in the novel at least. The main character, Jessie, a lot of the movie is a flashback. The book, I should say, is a flashback to her life with her abusive father. He molested her. I don't think she ever told anybody. The only people that knew were the two of them. So whenever she'd see him as an adult and they would hug, she would, actually apparently it was him, as I recall, would keep his ass, well, his dick, basically, far away from her. And that's what happens with Sarah and Harry. Now, I'm not accusing her of anything, but it makes me wonder, is that a connection in that way? Is it possible that maybe something bad happened to Harry with Sarah and or their father? She misses her husband, Sarah does so much, but maybe he wasn't a very good dad?
I look at that moment and that hug with them. It's an awkward hug, you're right. And I don't necessarily notice that it's because their crotches don't touch, although I don't think my crotch touches my dad's crotch when we hug.
But if you give a full body hug, though, then that's what's going to happen.
Doing a full body hug. So there's a parallel hug that happens between the two of them in her fantasy near the end of the film. Her prize when she goes on Tappy's show is her son, who's about to get married and is a successful businessman. And he comes out in a suit with his hair all clean, and he comes and he gives her this almost cloyingly warm hug.
Her ultimate fantasy.
Nestles his head into her neck. It's such a loving hug. So I wonder if it's more that hug, because it looks quite striking in the movie where you're like, ew, he would never hug her like that, because we've seen how they interact together, so you know how incorrect her fantasy is. So I would suspect that it's more played awkwardly to give the fantasy hug more of a contrasting look.
Okay, that's fair. Well, Sarah also really does bear out my theory that life is about having something to look forward to. Because people have been trying to figure this out for thousands of years. What is the meaning of life? And I don't know what it is either. But to me, it's as simple as that. Because when you get to be our age, or Sarah's age, or 95 years old, if you have nothing to look forward to, even at our age, it's pretty tough to get up in the morning.
I think life is a lot about connection, too. She doesn't have any people in her life, so...
She's got friends
She's got friends, but even as she says, it's not the same. And her friends are her friends, but what do they do when she gets committed to a mental hospital? They're upset, and they're sad about it, but then walk away like friends would. And Harry may not. When he discovers what's happened to her, he may behave differently. It's a different level of connection. And besides, that's the kind of connection that she wants. She has her friends, but maybe it's a little shallow. And what she really wants is a closer relationship with her son. She wishes her husband were still around. Maybe her fantasy life has put her late husband on a pedestal. That certainly wouldn't be the first time that happened. People die and they just get a halo, and that's that. So she could be living in her fantasy world as well. But loneliness can drive a person a little bit crazy. We have things to look forward to, sure, but you'll be the first to admit our lives are very predictable. I feel like I'm very boring when I haven't seen someone in a while and they ask me what's up, and I just have to be like, same old, but we're content and our lives may be a little predictable, but I'm happier this way. I'm happier now than I think I've ever been.
Well, next podcast we'll have to post. We'll have to record it before this happens, but we'll be coming back from a pretty nice vacation
down south. So. The same vacation, frankly, we take every January, but there's nothing wrong with that.
But something to look forward to for sure is that vacation, because we're going to what should be a nice warm week away from this part of the world. One of the big plot elements in this film, of course, is Tyrone being the main drug dealer. Harry's involved, but it seems like Tyrone's the one who works the streets more often. And he seems to be a loyal earner, as they say in the mob movies, until his boss gets his head blown off by a rival gang, and the business is screwed up. But one of the first times where Tyrone goes to jail twice in this movie, including at the end, when both he and Harry go, but he's the one that's actually in jail while Harry's recovering. I guess Harry's in the prison hospital while he's having his arm cut off.
But he didn't do anything illegal. Having used drugs is not a reason to
put... He existed while black.
Well, actually, I put together why he goes to prison is because he jumped bail. He got bailed out back in New York, and then he left the state and went to Florida. It's breaking the law, so then they sent him to prison.
One connection for sure as well, and maybe it's not intentional, but Midnight Cowboy. There are failures in New York, they head to Florida, and then in that movie, one of them dies, and this one just has something really bad happen to him.
They both have something really bad to happen.
Well,
to
way worse when your arm gets cut off and you could have easily, I would think, die from the infection you've got.
Well, they say graphic. When he's in prison and they see his arm, they're like, oh, he'll be dead in a week anyways. So he's probably going to survive. It seems like the hospital, why would you cut someone's arm off if it was hopeless? I guess it's a possibility that he's still very sick. But the movie, I think, implies that the worst thing that happens to him is he loses his arm. People talk about this film, they talk about how it's like the kind of film you can only see once because he really takes it to the extreme. But I guess because I've seen it lots of times, I'm quite immune to it now, and I don't find it that shocking or upsetting.
Me neither. It may be because we've seen movies that push it even further than this one does. A lot of horror films. And this is a horror film in a way. It certainly is to Sarah through a lot of the movie when she starts doing the drugs in wrong proportions, when she's taking them the way she's not supposed to, mixing and matching, and when her apartment comes alive. So it becomes a bona fide horror film for her.
Mm-hmm.
But we've seen movies like, say, Green Room. We just talked about that earlier. Brutal things happen when Anton Yelchin has his arm slashed by a machete.
It feels so deeply realistic.
And you don't see that happen. You see it happening to him while the arm is not on camera. But anyway, a movie like that, it's so graphic. And that is a pseudo-horror film, pseudo-thriller. This, I guess, is the same kind of deal. Awful-looking things happen, but it's more about projecting what's really happening to them until we see Harry's arm. If we never actually saw that arm, but saw the way he reacts, we'd have to imagine it. Maybe we shouldn't have seen the way it looked.
This film's so brutal, and I wonder if they can get away with making a more horrifying film because the subject matter is drugs. The 90s was this golden age for drug movies. Trainspotting, we already mentioned. There was also Basketball Diaries, which you mentioned. Drugstore Cowboy, Rush, Traffic, we talked about. But the genre seems to have lost popularity in the last 20 years, and the best movies about addiction that are being made now are from the perspective of the sober people who are helplessly watching someone they love kill themselves. Ben is Back was a great film. Beautiful Boy, Star is Born. And I kind of was wondering what the appeal was about the subject matter back then. Maybe it was an echo of the drug war. It was probably really easy to get a much edgier film greenlit if it served as a cautionary tale against drug use. I think studios probably liked that, and it felt like, well, if we have this moral cautionary tale, then we can get away with showing people some pretty gruesome and edgy stuff. Also, maybe films like this were more popular before 9/11 because that was just simply a very stable time and drug addiction was a high-stakes crisis rather than what it feels like now, which is kind of like a natural response to the state of the world. There's a way bigger opiate crisis now, but I don't know that this movie could possibly get made now because we just have a different perspective. But I think that in the 90s, for whatever reason, probably it was just a trend. People could use drugs to make essentially, like you describe, a horror film, and the villain is addiction, but the director can get pretty creative with their gruesome ways that their characters will be put through hell.
Partly because it isn't just about the drugs for them. It is about wanting something that they used to have and probably never have again.
I have a friend who had a heroin problem. I asked them once what it felt like. I was just curious. They had confessed to me that they had started using intravenous drugs. It was always kind of a pill problem, and then they had upgraded to using needles, and I was like, well, what does it feel like to shoot up? And they described it as a warm hug, a blanket of love.
Yeah, I read somewhere, I think it was Heron, because it was Pulp Fiction. I watched that a few weeks ago again. I've seen it so many times. But Travolta was told by somebody about how to handle what it's like to be on heroin is get stinko on tequila and then sink into a hot bath. And that might be a tenth or even a hundredth of the way it feels to be on heroin.
That sounds awful, being drunken in a hot bath, but
he loved the research. That's what I was reading. He enjoyed doing that.
I think it's a drug for somebody who's lonely. When she described it that way to me, I think I kind of understand how somebody who's sad and lonely would need exactly that.
And she hugs people full body.
She hugs crotch to crotch.
Crotch to crotch. Ass to ass. That's a weird way to give a hug, isn't it?
Imagine chanting ass to ass, ass to ass. I mean, maybe I haven't been to enough live sex shows to know how an audience normally reacts to stuff, but them circling and chanting like rabid dogs seems like an unusual way to behave. Anyway, we already talked about that.
So Aronofsky did The Wrestler and Mother, which we've covered before. Many other films. We mentioned Pi and Black Swan and things. We'll probably cover more of them as the years go on. But we had never covered the guy until just last year. Now it's three movies in about 6 months or so. With Mother and The Wrestler and now this. Quite a bit of split screen, especially early on, including the first scene, because Sarah's in the closet. She gives him the key to unlock the TV that she's hooked up to the radiator in the first place, but we see him on a split screen, and she's in the closet. And then Harry and Marion in bed, which is a weird way to shoot a movie, but a cool way, too, because they're right beside each other, and yet there's a split screen. So you see, I think it's her arm is up above, but it comes in the frame not quite where it normally would. It's a really strange touch, but I did like it. Fisheye lenses are used in this movie as well.
Oh, they have that gear where the camera's attached to the actors. They're running around.
I've never heard anyone else call it this before, but I listened to the commentary many years ago. Aronofsky did. He called it the Snorri Cam. And when you look online, it is called the Snorri Cam. S-N-O-R-R-I Cam. And I wondered, is it on all four of them? It definitely is on Burstyn and Wayans and Connolly. I don't know if it was on Harry. I don't remember that. Maybe it was.
But well, it'd be interesting for if it symmetry, wasn't... Yeah, it seems, because I can think of the three scenes like you just mentioned, but yeah, I can't remember something specifically with Harry. But
Wayans when he runs away from the cops, Connolly when she comes out of the shrink's apartment after fucking him, Burstyn in her apartment, I believe it is. Yeah, so anyway. But that is a really strange and obviously unsettling way to shoot somebody. Well, the camera's attached to them because the way the background looks, it's just odd, and that's the point.
The film is hyper-subjective. This is like another Aronofsky thing. He really likes the audience really honed in on the very subjective impression of his characters, and that's a great way to do it. The split screen I thought was neat as an expression of how they're close, but they're apart. The scene where they're having pillow talk, Harry and Marion, And they're supposed to be getting really close, but the performances are actually great as far as them just seem really spaced out.
They're not really connecting.
They're not really connecting. They're just talking. And what did she say? She goes, lots of guys have told me I'm beautiful before. I just never heard it, but I hear it with you. But you can see in her performance that she's not there. So they're connecting, they're facing each other, but the split screen provides the separation so that the audience is always going to understand. I mean, it's hyper-stylistic, but the audience is always going to visually understand that they're not getting out of it what they need to get out of it.
So Aronofsky wrote the movie along with Hubert Selby, who also wrote the book that became Last Exit to Brooklyn. I think it's actually called that for a book. And same with this. So this is the same title for the movie and the book. And this was Selby's 1978 book, so it took quite a long time, over 20 years, for it to actually reach the big screen. And I can see why. It's tough subject matter. Libatique shot it, got nominated for Black Swan and A Star is Born, and also shot Iron Man, so his resume is impressive. There's way more than that. Some great stuff on there, but those three really stood out to me. The editor, obviously got to give credit to Jay Rabinowitz, who cut this movie. Also cut 8 Mile, The Adjustment Bureau, which is a movie I like a lot, and other good works. He's another guy. You look at his resume and you can mention 8 or 10 others probably that are pretty damn good.
I don't think you could measure how influential this film was on editing, but particularly advertising. And I say that because I briefly worked in advertising, and the number of times marketing executives would say, make it like Requiem for a Dream. They would just shorthand it all the time. And I think for 3 years, every ad, and still to this day, you see it. Every ad uses some form of that hard audio cut montage. And that was something that I'm sure existed before the movie Requiem for a Dream, but after this film, it became a standard editing technique. Montages weren't new. Not even hard cut montages like that. As a matter of fact, I think music videos probably made them really commonplace. But the way that this stands out was those hard audio cuts. It's very abrasive, but it also has this staccato-like music. I think when they did it in such a way that it sounds like a song and then intercut with the score you were talking about, which is an electronic score. It blends in really well as just the whole audio scape of the film.
Clint Mansell, the composer, does work with Aronofsky quite a lot, but I don't remember a score ever standing out quite like this one did, and the Kronos Quartet.
So plaintive and beautiful, I absolutely agree.
Well, it's also huge a lot of the time, which is something you're not a big fan of, but in a movie like this, that fits. We've talked about that in horror films, or Star Wars, or something like that. Those kinds of movies need big scores. It's not going to be better if it's this low droning type of thing, or nothing at all. Usually, maybe those movies could be great without music, but I don't think that would be the case. But you love the editing by the sounds of it. It reminds me of Roger Ebert talking about doing frame-by-frame classes with people. A movie like this, God, how long would it take for them to get through it? It's only an hour and 40 or so minutes long. It would take them days and days just to get through one of the sequences when they show them shooting up the heroin. That would probably take an hour just to get through that one little bit, the few seconds of film. So yes, I think the movie is a great... Well, looking, maybe not the most beautiful film in the world, but Libatique did a good job, I think, for what Aronofsky wanted, but the cutting and the music stand out. Probably should have got nominations. Traffic did get the nominations. In fact, it was nominated for the big ones, and it didn't win Best Picture. The only thing it didn't win was Best Picture. We talked about that before. Jaws, Adventures of Robin Hood, and Traffic, but they won other awards. In fact, every other award they were nominated for, but not Best Picture. But my favorite movies that year, we're going to talk about some of them as the year goes on, now that it's 20 years ago. Wonder Boys, Almost Famous, we got to do that later this year. And I think Traffic's pretty excellent too, and mostly so different. Even the two drug movies are quite different.
Agreed.
And this movie is 185:1. We watched The Blu-ray, which has no features on it. Remember that. There's a commentary and a making of and all that on the DVD, but the Blu-ray has none of that stuff. I don't watch that stuff anymore anyway. If I had time for these podcasts to really learn more about them so I'd have even more facts, I would do that. But I have a job. I have a wife. I have dogs.
I'm a very demanding wife.
I have two podcasts out every week or every other week. And I think we already said what happens next. Tyrone has to get out of this life, and I think he can, but he better stay far away from Harry. Because it's not just Harry's fault. Tyrone's to blame, too. But Tyrone's the one who I think could kick this. And maybe Harry will now. Marion probably won't, and Sarah might be in that institution for the rest of her life.
Yeah, Sarah's the most doomed of the four, I'd say.
As I recall, she and Marion both smile when they turn to the right at the very end and they go in the fetal position. Certainly not Tyrone. He doesn't. And Harry's crying. But Marion, even though she just went through, well, maybe it wasn't minutes before, but she's come home seemingly from one of those ass-to-ass sessions. And as she turns to the right, I think she's smiling. And I know Sarah is. And the two women...
Marion is definitely smiling. Yeah, and the two women, she's happy she got a heroin.
Right. And the two women may be the worst off of the four of them. Anyway, you chose this movie, and I think it's a great one. I would have probably wanted to do this movie sometime this year anyway, but it is a month of bad movie. Your last thoughts on Requiem for a Dream.
Well, like I said earlier, I'm disappointed by the way the subject matter seems to be pretty heavy-handed and not necessarily standing up in 2020, but man, the style of it is impeccable. Still feels really fresh. Cannot underestimate how influential this film was. And if maybe you haven't actually seen this in a while because you're afraid to put yourself through the misery of watching this film, I gotta tell you, it feels less miserable every time I watch it. Maybe give it another shot. Don't let that stop you from revisiting it.
You're desensitizing yourself.
Sure. Also, it honestly has like a Reefer Madness level of silliness. As a society, we've all agreed that maybe drugs aren't this Autobahn ticket to hell the way everybody thinks they are. Not to say that lives aren't ruined by drugs, but this feels pretty histrionic.
Some people can do this stuff casually, or they can even do it hardcore, but they just have a different constitution. Other people, the minute they take that drink or put that needle in their arm, and the needle thing's way more serious, granted. So do the cocaine or do a diet pill, speed. They are fucked. And you don't know you're one of those people. How would you know? But it's like that line in The Shining book where something inside of Jack Torrance is broken. And the minute he took a drink, in a lot of ways, he was screwed forever without even knowing it. So I think Requiem for a Dream is definitely a 10, but maybe a little bit less than it used to be. Blew me away the first time I saw it. Still think it's a great film. I don't know what it's like to be high on drugs or completely strung out. I've been drunk lots of times. But this does feel fairly accurate, even though it's over the top.
It is an incredibly immersive film.
There's also something just beautiful in how simple their dreams are. They don't really want to be rich, necessarily. That's not really their goal. I guess the guys want to with the drug business, but more about just making money and getting to do their own thing and getting high on their own supply.
Yeah, they just don't want to keep robbing Harry's mom over and over again.
And having their boss shot dead right in front of them, and Tyrone's covered in blood. Ugh. Very sad movie, though, too, but a challenging, powerful one. Okay, as we said, we're off next week because we'll be vacationing in a place far from here. In 14 days, on January 27th, we'll stay very dark, and we'll also stay weird, but we'll get into some funny stuff, too, as we tackle David Lynch's Wild at Heart. I've never been a big fan, but it's one of your choices. I'm going to give it another chance.
I chose it almost more because I find our podcasts are more interesting when we disagree about a film.
Maybe I'll feel differently, too.
But I haven't seen it in a long time, and I also think it's going to be super interesting to talk about.
All right, the coming attractions trivia is pretty simple for Wild at Heart. Name the movies in which Diane Ladd plays Laura Dern's mother. They are mother and daughter, and how many times have they played mother and daughter?
Strictly in film?
Yeah.
All right, for the answer to that question, check out January 27th's podcast about Wild at Heart. In the meantime, you can go to our website, top100project.com. Please favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles. In exchange for all of this amazing content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. That helps people find us. If you'd like to reach me and Ryan, we're on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to your home, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive, for a 20% discount.
One quick programming note. Chris and I are going to do Rudy after this one. It'll come out the week that we're away. Probably not going to go up until the Saturday, though, because we'll still be on vacation on the Thursday. So anyone who listens to both of our podcasts, the Scoring at the Movies episodes and this one, look for Rudy on the weekend rather than on Thursday.
Yeah, if you're wondering where the new episode is, just imagine us on a beach with piña colada.
So let's go watch television and be excited. Be excited.
And cut.
Cut. Cut. Cut. Cut, 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 cut.